Today on Pipeline Things, it's the episode with Straight Fire. I literally have to say it is a rousing episode where we get into the difference between the way it is now and the way it should be. And we're talking about how or what is the relationship between regulations, standards, and research. And we talk to a very passionate, if not rousing, guest on this continued episode of the Sage Series. Hope you enjoy it today. All right, welcome to today's edition of Pipeline Things. I am your host, Rhett Dotson, my co-host, Christopher DeLeon, and we are continuing in this SAGE series of where we bring on, if you listen to our last one, I can use the word now because he actually gave us
The Geezer series.
And
compliments of Dr. Dave.
Compliments of Dr. Dave. So if any of our guests get upset, Christopher, they only
you
have...
You can submit all of your feedback... complaints to Dr. Dave. And I'm sure he would oblige.
We are absolved by all blame for the use of the word geezers, for sure. But I am enjoying this series. I mean, really, Dave kind of stoked a fire in me when we talked to him last time. And I think today's episode might just throw gasoline on that fire in me because I know that we're going to get another passionate individual. That individual is also very well known in our industry. Chris, I know he is a personal mentor to you, so I'm going to let you do the introduction.
It's his fault that I'm even here, to be honest.
Oh, God. I want everybody who listens to our podcast to
realize that. If you have another complaint about just this guy in general, you should send him to the guy that's on the podcast.
Yes,
this is all his fault.
You can blame our guest today for Christopher DeLeon. There are lots of people now who are getting ready.
Well, maybe not for me. Yeah, maybe not for me personally, like this person, but rather the fact that I'm here.
We'll have to ask him if he takes all responsibility for your actions. But the reason that I get so excited about this guest is this guest has authored a book. We're going to go through that in a bit. Yeah. But he has a figure in that book, and it specifically talks about the relationship between incidents, regulation, standards, and research, which was a topic in Dr. Dave's thing.
And a potential flow for those, right?
And his figure is perfect because it talks about the way it is now and the way it should be. And I want to give the audience, again, stop and think in your mind for a moment. The way it is now, the process is we have an incident, which then results in regulations, which standards then respond to, and on the tail end, we perform research.
To do it better. And you're onto something, right? So think about it, right? If you are currently in an integrity management team as an operator or even a service provider, how many times do y'all begin discussions or change management because of regulation? Is it compliance mindset or is it best practice mindset, safety mindset, process control mindset?
So that's the way it is.
Yep.
He also, our guest, presents the way it should be, which is research is the genesis, which then drives standards, which in turn then drive regulations, which... Yep. prevent incidents rather than being a primary cause. So that's, you know, again, if you're listening, that's going to be the shape of the podcast today. It's going to be an exciting guest. Christopher, would you like to introduce him and bring
him
on the show?
Jerry, come on down.
It's like the price is right.
Come on down.
Oh, Jerry, thank you so much for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, thanks for
having me. Oh, the audience is going to be super glad that you joined us today, too. So wait, no, we have to stand up the book. So we left the book sitting here. So if y'all are not familiar as the audience member, Jerry co-authored a book with several of his closest allies. I almost called it like a posse, like with the posse within the industry. And it is a really good book. By God, if I were in charge, like the title just comes right out and grabs you. And it's fair. All proceeds of this book go to
YPP.
To YPP. So Jerry,
none of the authors get any royalties, all the money. And thanks to Clarion for allowing us to distribute the book without charge.
What I have heard is that there are only limited copies left. So if you still want a copy, there are only limited amount left in print. Otherwise, it is accessible as on Kindle or electronic devices.
I do have a hard copy of it. And one of the things I've tried to do is get everybody who has a chapter in the book to sign the book for me. Because Fortunately, I do know all of
them. How close are you?
I'm about halfway. Okay. I could have gotten one today, but I didn't bring the book.
That's a fail.
Yeah, I did.
Jerry, if you don't mind, will you please introduce yourself to the audience? Where do you hail from? Sure. How did you find yourself here?
Number one, I do accept full responsibility for this guy. So again, it is
you're welcome,
it is.
And I'm sorry. Sorry, Jerry.
I take full responsibility for bringing
him. We will give out
him.
Jerry's email address later. That's and
Jerry.Rao@jtrain.com if you have any complaints about this guy. So how did I get to be where I am? Well, it's interesting. When I graduated from university in 1974, a few years ago, it was the middle of a recession. Yeah. And I ended up getting a job at a gas utility company. At that point in my career, I didn't even know pipe was round. And so as I started my job there, they had an internship, if you will, an internship. And they sent you around the company to learn different aspects of the industry. And at the end of that orientation, then they would say, here's the jobs that are available for you. Well, at the time, the Wisconsin Gas Company was in the forefront of applying polyethylene pipe to gas distribution. It was a relatively new thing back then in those days. It was right after we stopped using wood. Mm. No, I'm kidding. So at the end of the internship, I said, I'd like to get in the research department. They said, well, you're going to be a corrosion engineer.
Oh.
So it's kind of like the military. So if you ask for something, you most assuredly won't get that. So that's how I got into the pipeline business and how I got into the corrosion business. And even to this day, I still consider myself a corrosion engineer, although my trade and my craft and everything else taken me in many different aspects of the pipeline industry. I've been very blessed, if you will, in the career I've chosen. I've really enjoyed what I've done for all these many years. And I've never regretted any of it. I've met and worked with some of the most wonderful, spectacular people I can imagine. And I'm very proud of the things that the companies I've worked for have managed to accomplish.
Yeah,
you just claimed responsibility for some of the actions of your...
some I'm more proud of than others. Yeah, there's no doubt about that. Yeah.
Look, all I can say is this, your choice has had some good, because I've hired a lot of people for this industry as well, right? And there's a lot of you out there that can attest to that. But, you know, what I would say, Jerry, is I feel like we kind of still have that same vein, right? So you say, like, you wanted to do one thing, and the company said, well, you're going to be a corrosion engineer, right? I mean, I'm of a similar regard as well, right? Like, came at the time Southern Union, working in engine reliability, and then I ended up in pipeline integrity. I mean, I feel like that happens a lot, right? And I feel like it's kind of still that. But we've been incredibly blessed to be in pipeline. And I remember in our recruiting tactics, you heard me say this a bunch at our former employer, right? Where we would say, hey, you know, if you don't know much about pipelines, we think you're going to love this, because we sure as loved it. So,
interesting. One of the things that I still like to do is I'll talk to people and I'll say, how did you get in the pipeline business, right? I mean, there is no pipeline engineering course that you can take. I think there is actually one now. Yeah. I just saw that somewhere down
there. They're very rare.
But they're very rare. So it's always interesting. So I would suggest to the audience that if you want to have a good, interesting conversation with people that you meet at a conference or something, ask them, how did you get into this business, right?
There you go.
I guarantee you you'll have some really interesting stories.
And do you regret it?
Yeah. No, I freaking love it. Some of the best people you meet are in pipelines. I used to work with Ray Ayers when I was at Stress. Ray Ayers is one of those people that had 30 years at Shell before he retired and came back as a consultant for 20 plus years. Mm-hmm. And I remember Ray told me, like, when he first got introduced to pipelines, he said, are you serious? How do I get a career out of this? It's long, it's skinny, and it's got a hole in the middle of it. How difficult can it be? Mm-hmm. And like, most of us are that way, right? Like 20 years later, you're like, oh, these problems are so difficult. How do we figure this challenge out? It is deceptively easy looking, but really challenging problems that we face. And so it's a rewarding career. Well, Jerry, I want to dive right into it with you. You kind of heard me in the introduction really segue to, I think, what we're going to talk about today, which is the way it is versus the way it should be. And really that whole notion that we live in response to failures, right? And I think we understand why it is that way, even if we don't necessarily like it. We understand why it's that way.
And I do want to add a little bit. We're giving you a little bit of a poetic license here, right? So part of the Sage series is for for us and for our audience to have an opportunity to
go
hear.
Go ahead and say it, geezers. It's okay. Go ahead, say it.
Dave gave us license.
You're thinking it. Just go ahead and say it.
That we want to hear what the geezers really think, you know?
And I'm a proud geezer.
You know, it's
a vocal one, yeah, at that.
You guys were players, then coaches, and now you're on, you know, you're in the audience looking in and screaming at the coaches and screaming at the players, telling us, you know, it's open over there. Do it here.
And sometimes,
you know,
we screaming at the referee. That's another. We'll get into that later.
We want to hear some of that. So you have that license today.
Absolutely. So I, without further ado, jump right in. Yeah. You know, in that model you mentioned, research should be on the front end. That in the way it should be, research should be on the front end. But in the way it is, as you present it, it's on the back end. And one of the reasons you point to, and I think, you know, again, our audience may find agreement with this, or maybe they feel like it resonates with them. Maybe they should consider it. I want to hear, let's start as a starting point from you, a volunteer model. This is Jerry's quotes. A volunteer model with no accountability is not working. Roadmaps are not clear and distinct and not routinely shared. There is still no clear path on technology transfer. That's what you wrote in the book in regards to the research organizations.
So I have to take accountability for that.
Oh yeah, yeah. You got to own that one now.
Own that one.
It's on.
It's on me. Yeah, I get it.
Okay. By God, if I were the boss.
By God, if I were in charge. So, again, it's, since we're supposed to start with research, and you identify this as an issue, I'd like, what advice? How do you talk to us? How do we get around this? How do we fix it?
Well, let's talk about the history a little bit of why it got to be the way it is. And you think about how regulations were first promulgated was because of incidents back in the 60s and the 50s and the 40s and before that, right? So the federal regulations came about as a result of a failure, of an incident. And government decided it needed to take charge to provide accountability to our industry. I would guess, and even though I am a geezer, I'm not that old, that if I'd have been around at that time, we would have seen the same things, right? The operator said, the government's in, we'd have to write some standards, which they did, which was ASME B31, right? So they did develop some standards that they hoped would be incorporated into the regulations. Yeah. And they even began to do some of the research at that time. So PRCI, in fact, started about that time in the 50s. So there then became a research organization. As time evolved, the research organization was relatively small and still is relatively small. My argument, and I think I even say it in the book, is when you think about the amount of revenue that's generated by the pipeline company, by the pipeline industry, is in the terms of billions of dollars, right? Yeah. The PRCI model gets about 10 million, and I may be off now.
I think you quote 9 in the book, so 9 to 10.
Yeah, 9 to 10, and maybe a little bit more than that. Think about that as a percentage of revenue. Think about just about any other industry that you can think of, how much money as a percentage of revenue that they apply for research, and it's not 0.0001%, mm-hmm. right? So number one, we don't apply enough money and or enough resources in human resources. Yeah. So I'm begging the question a little bit, but the point is, if we spent more money in human capital and in dollar capital into the research side of our business, it would help turn that model around substantially. Yeah. And again, when we talk about the accountability issue, is when you have a volunteer organization, the accountability is way different then I'm trying to mince my words a little bit, than if the model was a little different, right? So is there an accountability when you get back to the office? And again, I'll look at the audience. If you are part of a research organization, what is your accountability when I get back to the office? What should I be advocating for when I get back to my office? Yeah. As I told this guy, when he was involved in that, I said, you are going to be accountable.
I had a really great dinner, though.
Yeah, but
had some really
dinner.
Fun people.
We had a great time. Hey, we had cocktails, and we stayed out
and
late.
The geezers are great at telling stories.
Yeah, we had great stories, right? But the point is, you need to be accountable for that, and it'd be part of your performance review.
Yeah.
Right? So when you get back from this organization, say, how am I going to apply what I learned? Yeah. And it's about just not just my organization, but the other organizations. When you think about the upside down pyramid, the pyramid the right way, the way I would think of it. When I get back then as part of a research organization, how do I get my advocacy carry over to the standard writing organizations, right?
Yeah.
I was going to say, I really like how you put it in terms of money and resources. Because I actually think money would be easy. But if you did nothing but throw money at an organization like PRCI, I don't you might, in fact, even make the problem worse by creating more research that can't be disseminated, that can't be understood, that can't be properly vetted. I really do think I resonate with it is incumbent upon the operators and to create a culture and enable their employees to be able to devote the time. That's the resource component that needs to come from the operators, not just the consultants filling the room, but really operators driving and holding their employees accountability for producing things.
And there's really, 100%. There's really a two components to this, I think, right? I mean, and again, you and I, at least we work to remind our audience of why we're doing this, right? It's information sharing. Right. So whether it's a relevant event like a certain IPC paper or a publication or an incident, I'm going to tie that to this. It's almost two pronged. One is that organizational leadership, like of what you're saying, Jerry, of saying, hey, we are invested in either this consensus standard development or in this research topic, whether it's through INGA or PRCI or a PHMSA project, whatever it may be in research. It's that. How are we bringing that back in and how are we contributing talent, not just money? But I think there's another component of is, which is us, right? Yeah. It's the you and me's of the world. It's our audience, the operators who are saying, what are you doing as a decision maker for integrity related or the budgeting or the time allocation of your team to say, how are we going out, learning from others, contributing to industry, and then bringing that back and integrating that into our decision-making process.
But that's the accountability piece, right? Yeah. So we talked about the resource allocation, but it's the accountability. Am I accountable? As we talked a little bit before we started this podcast, is the way it always has been is when the guy goes to an organization, whether it's PRCI or INGA or AGA or SGA, NACE or whatever it is. I know I shouldn't say NACE anymore. It's
AMP.
AMP, yeah. Sorry, can't get there.
you know, my wife told me, I have to interrupt. Keep your thought, right? My wife's like, Chris, is NACE the National Association of Catering? And I was like, what? Because Amanda is a bachelor from U of H in hotel restaurant management. She's like, NACE is the catering organization. I'm like, no, it's corrosion.
Different organization. But the point is that you would do the work outside of your everyday job in the dark underneath your desk, right?
Yeah.
Because your boss, and I was maybe guilty a little bit, but I hope not, to say, well, you do that on your own. Instead of saying, no, this is part of your performance review. This is part of your job. Yeah. That's how you get the ball rolling. You get the accountability piece. Yes, you're exactly right, Red. It's not just about the money. It's about that accountability. Well, and that goes to the top of the organization.
Yeah, and that's where I really want to challenge you, because I think your words are not even necessarily for people, young people our age. I mean, I think there are a lot of people that are our age that are probably getting into positions of management. Maybe they can use some of their influence to push. Yeah. But you mentioned them working after hours in the dark under their desk. Many of them are working after hours in the dark under their desk on the task that they've been assigned, much less something like research. I'm imagining audience members that are like, well, Jerry, am I supposed to spend the extra between 60 and 70 hours I work a week on PRCI-related things? And having done projects for something like PRCI, I often find myself as a struggle with you know, dealing with project champions that don't have the time to focus on the project, right? And that can really create challenges. So what advice, I mean, Jerry, what would you push for? Would you push for, I mean, you led a group of integrity engineers. Would you have a dedicated integrity engineer whose sole focus was PRCI? Would you make it 20% of their?
And we're using PRCI as an example, right?
Because it's one that everyone will resonate with.
But I mean, there's different mechanisms, right? And like AGA writes white papers.
ASMB 318
needs INGA Foundation sponsors work, whatever it may be.
Let's go. Let's any of these either research or standards organizations that need operator input. What looks better than what we have now with an integrity group?
It gets back to accountability, and that goes all the way up the ladder, right? Mm-hmm. So as a director of pipeline integrity,
as a title, it is a
responsibility to say it is your job to do these things because you're moving the ball forward as far as safety, consistency, which compliance will follow. So if you're not doing those things, part of your job is, yes, to make sure that we're a safe organization. How do we make sure that we're a safe organization? Yeah. Well, I want to make sure that there's the appropriate research being developed and the appropriate standards that my engineers can then fall back on and write the appropriate procedures and policies for my company to make sure that I'm as safe as I possibly can be. Yeah. And as I advocate, it's a safety first, consistency second. I want to make sure that everything that's done in our organization is consistent across the board, because that helps making it safe and reliable. And then finally, worry about compliance. Yeah. If you do the first two things, you have to be in compliance. If you're not in compliance, then there's something wrong with the regulations, right? If you're doing those two things correctly, and I have to reiterate that, if you're doing the first things correctly, then compliance should follow.
So say it another way. If you aim for compliance first, you may be safe or you may be consistent. But if you strive for safety and consistency, you should always be in compliance.
There you go. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, that's not always as easy as you would expect.
No, it isn't.
Because I remember once I was at a GPAC meeting when they were reviewing some of the proposed regulation, you know, and I heard that, you know, if I'm not mistaken, if somebody can correct me, but it was something along the lines of, you know, the Pipeline Safety Act was based on a cost benefit analysis to some degree, right? And so we already recognize that part of integrity management is risk management, and there's only finite resources, right? And so there's always that crux of saying, when I have to have a choice of compliance versus maybe what's best practice, there's always going to be some kind of consequence of not being compliant, right? And I would say that's maybe a cultural thing though as well, right? I mean, Rhett and I have had the blessing of serving a lot of clients over the last decade. And we do see some of those cultural differences, right? We'll see whether it's organizational leadership or just the talent management, right? Because it's all resources, whether it's money, time, or talent, right? Like I was talking to one operator, literally a couple of weeks ago, and he was like, Chris, we're struggling. And I'm like, what's up? Like, I'm a consultant, like, let me help. He's like, no, you can't help this one. And I was like, what's going on? He goes, we can't keep staff for longer than 18 months. I was like, well, that's a you problem. He goes, no, it's not a me problem. He goes, they're on rotational programs because they're learning about how to do inside the fence, outside the fence. Yeah. They're learning field operations. They're learning
integrity.
You're
trying to get me into trouble, aren't you?
No, I'm not.
Yes, you are. Because you know I'm going to.
I'm not.
I'm going to go off on this.
Hold on. We're not there yet. We're not there yet, right? And so my point is he goes, and you have to appreciate these kids or this young talent trying to get exposure and then making a decision. But I can't build competency, I can't build momentum when that's what I'm dealing with. Whereas I have another organization that we're working with where they have a different philosophy, right? Where they are building SMEs. I focus on ILI, right? I focus on project management. I focus on corrosion. I focus on field operations, and they work as a unit, right? And so not that one's right or one's wrong, but I do think that this whole idea of if we look at pipeline safety, consistency and compliance, I do think that there is an important joker or wild card in there that says, right now I feel like the culture that we're in pipeline integrity is kind of in flux, right? So it's kind of hard to say this is the way to do it.
Well, I'm going to twist it just a smidge.
Yeah.
You're right in that as things have progressed, and I use that word cautiously,
this is all still progress. If you moved a little bit forward, that's progress.
That's right. You know, back when I started, it was a good thing to be an expert in a field.
Yes.
You know, when you think about when I first started and the technical services organization, which I've been a part of almost my entire career, is there was an expert in this, in regulation. There was an expert in measurement. There was an expert in pipeline. There was an expert in blah, 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 blah. Yeah. And they were proud of doing that, and there was a path of improvement for those people, for those expertises, for those disciplines. Yeah. I don't see that as much anymore, and you guys can argue that.
It's okay.
You can say that I'm wrong. I don't know, because I've been out of the business a little while. In that progression of saying, what I want is a well-rounded engineer, that may be, to a certain extent, okay for the organization, but it's lousy for the discipline, right? So it's okay for the organization to say, Rhett, now you're going to know a little bit about measurement, and you're going to know a little bit about regulation, and you're going to know a little bit about this and a little bit about pipeline. That doesn't help the organization, I think, at all, because I need the experts that have been there, done that, seen that, and can advocate it and have accountability. We keep going back to the word, accountability for it. Well, I'd like to answer your question, boss, but I was doing a, you know, doing a job for the measurement group today.
Yeah.
And I see that. That was a big change that happened during my career.
Oh, I've got so many thoughts because, you know, one of the things that you're harping on, you're absolutely right. I think you're right, although I did not have the experience of working within a pipeline operator. I do have several of my clients and even close friends who do. There is a tendency to pigeonhole the SMEs now into certain places where there is no either path up or really it's just like, oh, that's the corrosion guy. I will go and find them when I need them, right? So I do think we have, I'm going to say maybe organizational issues and organizational cultural issues we should talk about. But I want to do that after the break because mm-hmm. I want to read another one of your famous quotes that you'll have to own up to from the book.
Accountability.
But accountability, that's what we're going to talk about. Right. But we're going to do that when we get back from the break. We'll be right back. All right, welcome back to Pipeline Things, where we are considering our continuing our conversation with Jerry Rao, and it's been a fun and rousing conversation so far. And I imagine the end of this episode will be no less fun and rousing. But I want to wrap up our conversation.
And no pun intended, rousing.
Yeah, I know. I thought about that too.
Wow,
I was going to drop that in.
It really
was really good.
I had no. I assume you've heard that. I'm sorry. God, that's terrible. Do we need to reshoot Trapest? She's saying no, we don't need to reshoot. Okay. I want to wrap up the conversation on the volunteer model with standards and objectives. And I just want to ask you just real quick, because I do think it's important as a sage. I want to ask you to give advice to two groups of people that our listeners fall into the camps. The first is, you know, our YPP group, our young people, new people to the industry. You know, Jerry, where would you tell them to go and what advice would you give them for trying to get involved in these volunteer organizations? That's question number one. And question number two is for those people who are in leadership, those influencers, those people who are you know, in their 40s that are leading a group, what advice and what recommendations would you give them for getting their people involved and holding them accountable?
So the first one, as far as the young engineers, as you said, YPP, which is not inclusive. And I don't mean that it's an exclusive organization, but the assumption is not all the young people in our industry are part of YPP. So the first thing is get involved in YPP, because that'll open the door to how to get into some of those organizations, especially if your particular company you work for is not promoting that. So again, by starting with YPP, they can say, here are the organizations that we're involved in, here's the people that support us, and it's just a natural door opener. Yeah. If you are already part of YPP, or if you're not.
What if you aged out?
That's a good question. I have aged out, by the way. but there are a bunch of organizations, and I think what you can do is talk to these two guys and say, What are the classic ones? Obviously, PRCI we've talked a lot about, ASME we've talked about, API is a really good one. And I guarantee you, if you reach out to any of those organizations, get on their website and say, how can I volunteer? You will get lots of responses.
Or go find your local geezer.
Or find your local geezer, right. And then on the other side, the question is, what should management do to promote that? Again, it's relatively straightforward. You be accountable. Make sure that you give the opportunities, and I always say this, and my wife Jane says you got to be careful how you say this. I say, what I want my engineers to be is presentable, and I don't mean that because they're well dressed or good looking or anything like that. I mean that they have the skill sets that they can become in front of people and voice their opinions appropriately.
For
right?
Substance.
For substance, and that's part of a supervisor's job to make that person presentable. Because once they're presentable, then they can go. Give them the opportunities, and you know they're gonna represent your organization appropriately. And then lastly is to make sure that you support those efforts by your employees. And I've said it a few times already. Make it part of their performance review. Yeah. Chris, when you go to these organizations, I'm going to ask you at the end of the year, did you go? What did you learn? What did you bring back to my organization? Make me accountable and make them accountable, because then I can go to my senior management and say, this is why it's so valuable for Chris or someone else to be involved in this, because guess what? We got a standard that was written. Yeah. We got this research done that we're now doing the same job better than we used to. So that's the short answer.
All right.
Yeah, I would also say, guys, if you are in one of those positions, there is a lot of opportunity out there. I mean, Absolutely. Between Rhett and I, we participated enough industry initiatives, whether it's standards developments or working, presenting papers, those are also good entry points, right? I would say the first thing is that sometimes these conversations can be a little bit awkward because you don't know what you don't know. I would just say, encourage you to start having those conversations, right? Ask your peers, ask your supervisor, and just start somewhere. And then one thing will lead to the next.
And I'll give a shout out to my old company, Panhandle, which I always think is my old company, is I had those have had those opportunities, and I was always supported in that regard.
Yeah.
And I've taken that passionately as I've moved forward through my career.
Yeah. Okay. And you know, Jerry, one of the things I feel like on this theme of accountability, right, is it's, I wanted to ask you, so true or false, you stood up an IMP from scratch.
I did.
Awesome.
True. Your Honor.
We didn't make him take an oath when he got on the
it's,
show.
It's been pretty close to 20 years since you put that IMP in place. True or false?
Way more than that. I started with Panhandle in 1991 as a corrosion engineer. Within 6 months, I ran the first smart pig on the Panhandle Eastern System as the corrosion engineer and the only one in the integrity department, which we didn't even call it that. I ran all the smart pigs. So quite literally, me and my bosses who supported me in that effort started an integrity management program in 1991. Okay. And then by 1998... is that 98? Eric, was that 98?
maybe you a little earlier. Whispering in your ear.
Of course I do. maybe a little earlier than that is when the official group was formulated. And we actually hired a corrosion engineer. We hired a pipeline engineer. And, of course, Marvin Hovis, the codes engineer.
Marvin Hovis.
God bless you, Marvin.
Yes. Learned a lot from that sage.
Yeah. So it was a relatively small group, but then it expanded from there.
So the question—
And just to finish, the most important thing that we did is we realized that it couldn't just be the engineering group to run this. So we knew how important data was. So data management was a critical part of the group. So GIS, which was even then was just kind of in the forefront, we made sure that GIS was part of the group as well. That's something to make sure that you think about when you look at the organization that you have for your pipeline integrity department.
Yeah.
Do you have the GIS group closely aligned?
Yeah.
Sorry.
No worries. So the question—
I was looking straight at the camera.
No worries. No, it's good. GIS. I think the question is, you know, you've had an opportunity to see how a lot of your decisions panned out. Not hiring me. We're talking about the integrity management program. looking back, what are some lessons learned, right? Because I feel like a lot of times there's a snowball effect, right? We heard Dr. Dave talk about this with, you know, how B-Throne 8S kind of formed and how it's come into play in the same vein, right? You know, you spun up an integrity program. Now, 20 plus years later, you kind of see how some of those decisions can have residual impacts. You know, what are some of the lessons learned that you'd like to share with the audience?
What ways do you see us maybe moving where you say, I don't know if that's a good path necessarily that we're taking with integrity management today? So wide open.
It is wide open. And I think what I'll do is I'll continue to reiterate some of the things we've already talked about. Is the Pipeline Integrity Department needs to be involved in the process as well as the data. You know, I think you can use one of my quotes in the book is we've always been really good about data management, but not process management. Mm-hmm. So I think the biggest failure that I still see in organizations is having truly a process management philosophy and a process management process, if you will, right? So we're good at managing day-to-day stuff. Did you run the pig?
Yeah, yes, I ran the pig. I did.
Did you get all the data? Yeah, I got all the data. Did you do the digs on time? Yeah, I got all the digs done on time. But what did you learn, right? What did all that information tell you? Or conversely, what should I now know that I didn't know before? Again, one of my quotes is, learn what you don't know what you don't know.
Yeah, so
and
system.
That's one of our big failures.
Yeah, for being systematic.
Systematic, right? Yeah. What did this process? So again, I wrote down that I ran the pig. But did I talk to everybody that was involved in the process? How did this work? How did this work? How did this work? And how can I make the overall process management better?
Yeah, what I feel like PHMSA often says to kind of blanket that is it's data integration.
Right. It was more than just data.
Yeah, what I'm saying is it's process. I feel a lot of times that's kind of like the lingo I hear a lot of times when we work with a customer and they're like, hey, you know, PHMSA is asking us about data integration and what those processes look like, right? Or we'll hear a slide deck from one of the regulators that says, hey, you know, data integration is fundamental and where'd you do it? Or it's almost like a catch-all, right? They'll find something that they wanted you to consider and they'll say, where did your data integration consider this? I think that's kind of like one lingo. But I think what we're talking about in your language is it's the systematic approach of having processes that are all interconnected so that you can ultimately integrate the information you need to make really good choices.
Right. And I've used this example many, many times, and I may even have put it in the book. But what we're really good at is if we dig up a pipeline and there's a sleeve on it, mm-hmm. I made a repair.
Yeah.
And I go look in my data and say, yep, we put a sleeve on that and it was a type B sleeve, and it was made out of this material, and here's the world of qualifications, and blah, 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 blah. But what we don't have anywhere is why? Who made the decision to put that sleeve on?
Yeah.
And why was that decision made? And how do we learn from whether that was a good idea or a bad idea? And I'm not saying that putting a sleeve on is a bad idea.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is why and who made that decision?
Yeah.
What was supported that decision?
Yeah.
What else did we learn about that decision instead of just saying, well, there was a leak and we put a sleeve on?
Well, we missed that because the integrity engineer on the job is now in measurement.
Yeah. Yeah, good point. You know what I'm saying? I mean, that's
Rhett and Christopher hired him. Sorry.
Okay, did a lot of your engineers use type A sleeves too?
Don't answer that question.
Don't get me started. Don't get me started.
I know at least one of them. You know, Jerry, as you were saying that, what was grinding at me, and I was really chewing on it, was one of our close friends says the only thing we learn from history is that we don't learn from it. And we know from the NTSB's public presentations that they've been on a mantra of, it was one of the drivers behind the failure file series, was we're not learning from our failures. As an industry, the NTSB comes out and produces these failures and has these recommendations, and the industry fails to learn from them, we repeat our mistakes. And there was a big component of that process, because when you said we don't do process well, I was like, what does he mean by that? And what I was hearing is we're not incorporating the lessons learned on the back end.
And that's part of it.
And that is, I feel like, just unfortunate, because I'm like, well, it feels like it's permeating everything we do, right? Are we not learning from failures? Are we not learning from the NTSB? Are we not learning even from our own experiences? And you know, maybe that's a big takeaway, is that we need to get better at doing that as an industry, learning from our failures and incorporating those failures into our future processes.
I'll give you an example. When I left Panhandle, and I'll always say Panhandle, sorry, and started the consulting business, we worked with a client, and they had a failure. And we looked at the failure, and they said that we need to come in here, not do a failure analysis, but how do we get better from this? Well, how can we learn from this? And we looked at it and we said, we knew for a fact that that company had a procedure that should have prevented that failure. Yeah. And they weren't doing it. And I looked around the room, and no offense, they were all young engineers. Yeah. And they said, well, where's the procedure? I know you have this procedure. We didn't know we had it. Mm-hmm. So this goes to the Geezer series as well. Yeah. So what we need to make sure is that this historical knowledge, knowledge transfer, but the historical knowledge that should be passed down.
Okay. Institutional knowledge.
Institutional knowledge.
Yeah, knowledge needs to be transferred from one leadership to the next series of people
that's
responsible.
That's right. And that's part of process management. Are you continuing to do the things that you know that you're supposed to do? And I go back to safety first, consistency second, compliance will follow.
Absolutely. It's a culture. I think Rhett and I, you and I see this all the time, right? I mean, how many times do you and I help operators solve the same problem, but it's just a different operator, right? And we go back and we say, hey, have you not read this IPC paper? Or we actually presented this at PPIM at least twice over the last 3 years. And what we often find is there's maybe a challenge in integrating new information into integrity programs, right? Like a feedback loop or a continuous improvement loop.
Rhett said it, lessons learned. I mean, we're not good at that. And again, that is part of process management, but it's obviously a big part of it.
Yeah. And it's something that's, you know, just dawning on me, you know, maybe leaving thoughts. So, you know, I think I think this is a good place to actually kind of put a bow on and tie up the episode. Jerry, I want to say thanks for joining us. It's been a lot of fun talking with you. I hope maybe we see you again, because I think these are issues that are not going away anytime soon. And also, you know, again, as a plug to our audience, just want you guys to think, if you do want to know where to get started in an organization, Christopher sits on several API committees. I am vice chair of the O&M subcommittee on B31-8. Happy to get volunteers plugged in there. There are tons of places within PRCI and your own organizations. I'd say start with asking, for sure. And hopefully you took away something from this episode as we look forward to improving. And again, Jerry, just want to say thanks for joining us. And so this is the end of Pipeline episode. What am I doing? My gosh, I'm struggling. Chris, will you wrap us up?
I can wrap it up.
Jerry's going to wrap it up. For a first on Pipeline Things, our wrap up will happen with Jerry.
Read the book. Read the book. And truly, if you want to contact me, I'd be happy to hear from you. You may not get that from every one of your members, but I'd be happy to hear from you again. Jerry.Rao@jtrain-inc.com.
And there you have it.
We are Pipeline Things.
In 2 weeks, we'll see you again.
We will see you.